Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show for you today. My guest will be Anna Lappe, and I'm so excited to have her on again. She was on a few years back, and I'm having her on again so that she can talk about some of the really exciting new things that she's involved in. And I will tell you more about her in just a little bit. But first, I want to, of course, share a recipe with you and go over some things going on in the news and some events happening in the metro area. This past weekend on Saturday was the Sandy 5 March, and I am so bummed I did not end up going. I had all intentions of going, but life got in the way. But it sounded like it was great. I looked on the news, and of course, you know, I'm reading the New York Times Sunday looking for an article, Monday looking for an article, and there's nothing. The best that I found was on Monday. They did talk about 5 years after the storm and how so many of the plans that they have in place to do some remediation of the infrastructure to create safeguards against another superstorm are still in the planning stages. Very little has really actually been done. Yes, they've moved some electrical boxes onto, you know, off the ground onto second stories and done some of the infrastructure like that. But the real projects that have been planned have not been implemented yet. And they're really just talking about how we really got to get our act together. We don't have that much time. If we don't, you know, take some action to really strengthen the infrastructures in New York and the surrounding areas for another storm, we are a city on the water. And when we have a superstorm or a hurricane like Sandy, we will get devastated again unless they do some of these safeguards that are in the plan. And one of the purposes of the Sandy 5 march that happened on Saturday, there were thousands of people that did march over the Brooklyn Bridge and rally in front of the Alfred Smith houses in Lower Manhattan. The call was to raise the awareness for our elected officials. I mean, they have the awareness. They're just not doing anything with it. They know that they need to take some action. We need to fortify the walls around the city, make some safeguards for if there was another rise in the oceans. What are we going to do? And the plan that they do have of the Big U is only around Lower Manhattan. They're ignoring Long Island and Staten Island and the Rockaways and all these other parts that were heavily impacted in the last storm. So please, everybody, you know, go onto my website, go onto Anna's website that we'll be telling you about later, and sign petitions, write letters, organize in your communities, get involved in raising or pushing our elected officials to really take some action, to take this climate change issue seriously. I know we are dealing with an administration that is not just in denial, but is in a denier that this is even a problem. And that is a huge problem, but it's one we all have to deal with right now. So we need to mobilize in our own communities and make some action happening. Some things going on that I want to share with you. November 1st, there is a series going on, part of a chef and doctor series at the Bouley Botanical Gardens. This one's on brain food. And it is on Church Street in Tribeca on Wednesday, November 1st. And it should be an interesting event. If you are interested in it, you can find a link on my website or Google Brain Food, the Chef and Doctor series, and you'll find out more information about that. Also, there is a tour and tasting at Goodwater Farms. This is being sponsored by Slow Food East End, and that is going to be a great event, touring some of the farms, Goodwater Farm out there that produces microgreens, and it is in Bridgehampton. I just got an email that they still have 4 tickets left, so if anybody's interested, that's worth checking out. November 3rd through 4th is the New York City Food Loves Tech Industry Conference, and that's a real a real question as to where technology comes into food production and if it can really help. And it's certainly helping in some apps and in some areas. There's a whole debate, as I know you've heard me talk about before, about aquaponics and hydroponics and whether that's really considered organic and whether that's good. It's certainly better than conventional agriculture, but I know the organic farmers that I'm involved with certainly would not consider hydroponics organic. There's a whole push and movement, as I've talked about before, keeping organic in the soil. And the definition of organic is really about growing soil, growing healthy soil, and that's what we need to do. Healthy soil, as we'll talk about later in the show, healthy soil can not only is better for the land, but it helps mitigate the climate change. It helps sequester some of the carbon that is in the air into the soil where we need it. It's not good in the air, but it is good in the soil, and that's where we want to put it. And putting all the organic matter into the soil is really helpful for that. So anyway, this Food Loves Technology industry conference is one that is certainly worth going to. I did attend one last year, and it was very informative. And it's taking place at Industry City in Brooklyn on November 4th and 5th, and you can buy tickets for the whole event or just parts of it, so check that out. This weekend, November 5th, is the Craft Fair at Restoration Farm. Restoration Farm is an unbelievable farm if you haven't visited it before. It is our local CSA farm here in Nassau County, and it's at Old Bethpage Village, and they're having a craft fair, which is always a wonderful event, and you can get a lot of your early shopping done with really great gifts. So that's a fun event to go to. November 6th at Columbia University, Mark Bittman, former New York Times journalist, is hosting every month or even every couple of weeks an event. This one is called Food as Global Commodity, and it's at the Education Center at Columbia University from 6 to 7:30 p.m. And this one, Timothy Weiss from the Small Planet Institute, which we'll be talking about also later in the show, will be the guest there. So Food as Global Commodity should be a really interesting evening. I am planning on going, and I hope to see some of you there. November 8th, Urban Food Policy Forum up at New York City Graduate Center for public health. This is also a wonderful free event that happens on a regular basis from 9 to 10:30 in the morning. It's open to the public. And this one is talking about urban food policy, New York City since 2007 and lessons for the next decade. Also really interesting. If you're interested in food policy, this is a place you will want to go. Slow Food New York City is having a fundraiser on November 8th. Always fun to check out, and it's at Project Farmhouse, which is a wonderful new venue in New York City for all things food. So we've had lots of book launches there and fundraisers for wonderful nonprofits. So if you haven't seen Project Farmhouse yet, that's a wonderful place, and this will be a great fundraiser for Slow Food New York City, which is a wonderful nonprofit organization that you know is very close to my heart since I've run the chapter here on Long Island for the past 8 years. So check that out. November 9th is the annual River Fund Gala. River Fund is the food pantry that I partner with every year for my Thanksgiving feast and Christmas dinner. The River Fund is a food pantry unlike any other that I know of. They not only provide food that they get from the food New York City Food Bank, but they also act as a safe home for people who are dealing with abuse issues, children that need help with homework, unwed mothers needing needing equipment for babies. They have monthly baby showers for mothers. They just do so much. They get involved in the families, and they really act as a support. And this is an unbelievable organization. The fundraiser, you know, the gala is really amazing. This is their main fundraiser. And, you know, it's a bit pricey, but if you can find it in your budget to come, it's really a fun party. So that's on November 9th, Thursday, November 9th. And I have so many other events here coming up, but I'd like to just tell you to go to my website to look at them. I don't really want to take the time here on air to go over them all, but do check them out. They're really wonderful. I'm going to share my recipe with you now. For the next couple of weeks, I'm going to be focusing on Thanksgiving recipes. Since Thanksgiving is around the corner, it's hard to believe. I feel like I just had Thanksgiving, and here it is again. But that's what happens with the cycle of life. It just keeps getting faster and faster. So this is a Thanksgiving stuffing with burdock, mushrooms, apples, and pecans. And I do start with a package of either Arrowhead Mills or Chatham Village stuffing mix. Find a good organic stuffing mix that you are comfortable with. You know, you can find gluten-free ones. This will work with a gluten-free one as well. And then I use a cup and a half of vegetable broth. I usually have some in the freezer that I can defrost, or you can, of course, use a bouillon cube or some sort of, you know, pre-bought vegetable broth. 1/3 cup of olive oil or butter, depending on whether you're making this vegan or not. You could also use coconut oil. I use 2 10-inch pieces of burdock root that I grate. And burdock root I use a lot in recipes just to give a little umami, a little depth to the flavor, some deeper nuances that you don't really know where they're coming from, but they're just delicious. That's what I use burdock root for. 1 onion chopped. 2 gala apples or Granny Smith apples that are cored, peeled, and cubed. 2 portobello mushrooms chopped. 3/4 cup chopped pecans and fresh herbs from the garden, either thyme, rosemary, sage, parsley, whatever you love. And you're going to bring the vegetable broth to a boil along with whatever fat you're using, butter, oil, or coconut oil. Add the stuffing mix and stir that in. Let that sit covered for about 5 minutes. And meanwhile, in a cast iron frying pan, you're going to saute in a couple tablespoons of olive oil, the burdock root, on a low flame, and let that cook for like 10 minutes. You really need to get the burdock root soft. Then you add the onions and saute those for another 5 minutes. Add the apples and let those cook for another 5 minutes. Add the portobello mushrooms and let those cook down. And then you're going to add all those vegetables to the stuffing mix. Then add the pecans, mix it up well, add the fresh herbs, and then you bake it in an oven for about 20 minutes before serving. And some of people's favorite parts are the parts that get crusty around the edge. So, you know, grease whatever pan you're putting it in or spray it with some oil and pack it in a casserole pan and cook it and let it get crispy on the tops and on the sides. And that's it. Super easy. Super delicious, and I will share more with you next week. And now it's my pleasure to introduce to you my guest, Anna Lappe. She promotes health, equity, sustainability in food systems through her writing, her advocacy, her public speaking engagements, and philanthropy. She's authored and co-authored 3 books and contributed to over 12 others. Her Diet for a Hot Planet, The Climate Crisis at the End of Your Fork, and What You Can Do About It, was named by Booklist and Kirkus Reviews as one of the best environmental books of the year. She's written a lot. She's co-founder of the Small Planet Institute and Real Food Media. She's just a force to reckon with. Anna, are you with me?
I am. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks so much for joining me. As you know, I love the work that you and your mom are doing and that you're doing, and it's just amazing. And when I first met you, you were living in New York in my area, or on the East Coast in Boston, I guess, and working with the Small Planet Institute.
Yep.
Right. And you co-founded that with your mom. And since you've moved to the Bay Area, you founded the Real Food Media. Can you tell us about the Real Food Media and how you collaborate with the Small Planet Institute?
Sure. So Real Food Media is a project that I run with a colleague based out of Chicago. And our vision is to catalyze really creative media and communications to help tell the story of the solutions of sustainable agriculture, as well as to really help people understand the real impact of industrial food and farming. And we partner with colleagues around the country on various projects and communications efforts. And the one that we're really excited about right now is we've been working with our partners at a group called Food Chain Workers Alliance and another group called the Center for Good Food Purchasing. And we've been helping to promote this really powerful new policy that city governments and school districts can pass to help them incentivize buying food using our tax dollars to buy food instead of suppliers that offer this bid, but to go to suppliers that actually embrace our shared values. So we've been helping public policies, really helping build capacity for the coalitions working to pass these policies on the ground. And that's just one example of what we've been doing at Real Food Media.
And is that something that is national, that you've been working with many different cities? Or are you focusing Chicago?
It's national. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's national. So the policy passed in 2012 for the first time. The city of Los Angeles' school district, which is one of the three biggest school districts in the country, so not a small feat there. And the idea is it's a purchasing policy that has institutions, public institutions like school districts, look through five value lenses when they're buying food. So the lenses of nutrition and health, of the environmental impact of the supplier's food, of worker well-being, animal welfare, and local economies. And when it passed in 2012, we've already seen incredible change in the food that those kids in that school district are getting. The amount of local fruits and vegetables has skyrocketed. When the poultry contract came up for renewal, instead of the rubber stamping of another five-year, $60 million contract to Tyson Chicken, the school district started asking bigger questions about of their chicken and ended up going with a supplier that guaranteed that the chicken would be raised without any subtherapeutic use of antibiotics. So it's just one example of the kind of impact the policy's had. And yes, it's national. So there's Oakland, California, and San Francisco schools have also passed it. Chicago City Schools passed it. But it's also city governments can pass it for city food purchasing. And we also there's active coalitions in about half a dozen other cities, and about 20 other cities beyond that are excited about getting a campaign started to pass the policy in the city as well. So maybe your town is
next.
That's
exciting. How about New York?
and New York is one of the places that we are in conversation with New York. But as you can imagine, you know, it's a heavy lift. But as you can imagine, passing it in New York would have huge, huge benefits for kids throughout the city. So we're in active conversations there as well.
I'm sure you heard that New York City this year started free lunch for all.
I did. That was really exciting.
Really great. And they have instituted more local purchasing, but it's still a drop in the bucket.
That's a good point. One of the things we're really stressed with this work around this purchasing policy, it's called the Good Food Purchasing Program. People can check it out at goodfoodcities.org. But we really are working in solidarity with and alongside groups on the ground that have been working for years to try to get better food into school. So, I know in New York City, you mentioned I used to live there. There was so much work to try to connect the schools in the New York City Department of Food with farmers across the state, trying to bring that food and connect it to the students. And so there's a lot of work like that that's been happening around the country, and we see this policy as really just being another step in, you know, these decades-long battles to get our kids access to healthy food.
Yeah. I've worked with the New York Coalition for Healthy School Food, which is now actually called the Coalition for Healthy School Food because they've expanded beyond just New York. And last week, actually, this past Thursday, was their gala. And they've actually managed to bring plant-based food at least into every school district, so every school, so that there's an option besides just peanut butter and jelly.
Mm-hmm.
I think hummus is in every school, so there are options. And I think New York City is also implementing at least, I know 15 Brooklyn schools took it up this week, the Meatless Monday campaign,
mm-hmm.
which
mm-hmm.
also is
exactly
a little drop in the bucket, but
yeah,
something.
But it all makes a difference. And that's one of the
yeah.
things that we have found, and there's been some great research done on the implementation of this policy. And one of the things we found is that when you actually focus on better food, and in the case of meat and dairy, better meat and dairy, that has less of an impact on the environment and better animal welfare, you know, that can sometimes cost per unit more to the district. But we found that districts have been going the path of less meat, better meat. And in the case of Oakland, California, for instance, the district did a massive study of implementation of the policy there, and they found that as a school district chose to buy higher quality meat, they served less of it. They did not get any complaints from the students, and the quality of the food was better, and they had researchers analyze the environmental impact of that shift, and they found that moving to better animal husbandry, meat that was raised under better environmental conditions, that ultimately essentially had the district saving so much water, so much energy, improving environmental impacts, all the choice that was, you know, part of this policy, and that had, you know, benefits to the health of the kids and reduced the amount of meat and dairy that was being consumed, again, while keeping everybody pleased. So, you know, I think it is an example of how a policy can help incentivize districts to move in a direction of better health and better environmental impacts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, you know, something that I talk about a lot is that the cafeteria really can be a extended classroom. I mean,
mm-hmm.
people should be learning about food in the cafeteria, and we, you know, the kids learn by role modeling. They learn by what they see, and it's hard to talk to them about nutrition in the classroom and then give them garbage in the cafeteria. Just
exactly.
doesn't equate. Now, the work you've been doing with Real Food Media, your films are just amazing, I have to tell you. I've used them, many of your films, in a food and film series that I run with Slow Food on Long Island. And they're just wonderful. And along with the Real Food Media, you also have Food Mythbusters. I'd love you to tell me a little bit about the difference between those two organizations, and also, you know, how your films really
mm-hmm.
focus, so many of them focus on, you know, busting some of these food myths
yeah.
that people think exist.
Mhm. Mhm. Oh, well, thanks for that. Yeah, we've had so much fun with the work we've done around these short films. So the Real Food Films Contest was a program of Real Food Media, and Food Mythbusters was another one of our programs. And with the Food Mythbusters work, we produced two relatively short online videos that took on two of the biggest myths that we've seen out there when we talk about the benefits of healthy eating and the benefits of organic agriculture. One is the myth that we can't feed the world this way, that we need chemical agriculture to feed the world. And so in what we hope is the most condensed way possible, of course, one could write entire dissertations about this topic,
right.
We try to take on that myth and really help people see that actually the literature shows and the lived experience of farmers around the world shows that the very best way to feed the world is to liberate farmers from dependence on fossil fuels, which includes petroleum-based chemicals, pesticides, which includes synthetic fertilizer, to liberate those farmers to be able to really nourish their soil with organic practices, and to deal with pests and weeds through organic practices, and that this is both a way that helps farmers become more independent and gets them out of debt, but it also produces abundant food, and it creates farms that are more resilient during the weather extremes that we know are our present and our future thanks to climate change. So that was one example of our Food Mythbusting movie, and you know, it really was about trying to think about how can we at Real Food Media create materials that can help shake up people's thinking and get people to realize how much myth-making is out there by the food industry, and help people understand what's real and what are some of the stories that really need to be heard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is so hard, especially now when, you know, fact-checking has become a whole industry in itself.
When we started Real Food Media, right, it was before the phenomenon became public of fake news, and
right.
We write a lot about how the food industry uses a lot of surreptitious tactics and its messaging and information, and you know, I feel like all of that is just on steroids today. So we all have to become that much more savvy about where we're getting our information, who do we trust, and how do we parse out that truth from fiction.
Mm-hmm. I know that I'm sorry, I'm having a blank. I'll come back to it. I know this year Real Food Films is also focusing their energy on three key issues: taking on big soda, building power with food workers, and tackling climate change through food. Can you tell us how Real Food Media is really working on that?
Sure. So for about 3 years, you mentioned our work with Real Food Films, which was an international short films competition that we ran every year. And this year, instead of running the competition again, we did it for 3 years, and it was a three-year initiative that we were thrilled about. But this year, what we decided to do, really based on people's asking us to do it, was to provide people a deeper dive into three key issues. You mentioned them: taking on big soda, building power with food workers, and tackling climate change through food. And to do a deeper dive into each of those topic areas, and to produce a reel of short films that people can screen in their own communities, and then providing organizers of those events a toolkit to help them catalyze a conversation among people who've watched that media about what's possible in your own community to do around these issues. Are there ways to tackle big soda in your neighborhood? Are there ways to partner more directly and support food workers in your community? Are there things that do policy-wise in your city to help tackle climate change through the food system? So our toolkits will help spark those conversations, we hope, and give people access to resources to take action. And all of that can be found at Real Food Media. We're rolling out the first toolkit within the next month or so.
Uh-huh. And so do you have many films on these issues, or are you focusing on really one film on each of the topics?
Yeah, they're again, this short films. So each reel has several short films that we've either pulled from our archives or have partnered with other media makers to access. And so each toolkit has a reel of films, but again, all short films and a range of different films that explore the topic from different angles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the thing that I loved about the short films is that it's just enough to spark the conversations. And then, you know, we mm-hmm. always paired it with a speaker. So then we really had
great
conversations, and you can cover so many topics in an evening when you do it that
mm-hmm.
way. But what
well,
you're doing is actually, you know,
that's
really nice to focus in on just mm-hmm. one of the topics mm-hmm. at a time and really mm-hmm. kind of make some headway, because we just leave everybody thinking about everything, but not necessarily with actions that they can take.
Mm-hmm. And both are important, but I think that, yes, our thought was for this year's films programming to go a bit deeper. But, you know, it's great to hear how you've incorporated the films into your events. And you're not alone. We've had more than 300 different community groups from all around the world, actually, to incorporate Real Food Films programming into events that they've hosted. And it's been great to see the reach around the world and the interest around the world in these topics.
Mm-hmm. Well, and like you said, film is just such a great way to do it. Everybody loves a good film, you know, and
mm-hmm.
especially if you pair it with a speaker and some food, you know, you got a successful evening. I have a question that, you know, I haven't really gotten the answer to, and maybe you can help me. You know, one of my issues is someone who, you know, cares about what my children are putting in their bodies.
Mm-hmm.
I have a lot of concern about diet soda as well as
mm-hmm.
sugary
mm-hmm.
soda. And I'm wondering why we haven't just taken on all soda. Why are we only focusing on sugar soda? I mean, I know
mm-hmm.
sugar, as we all know, is terrible for you. But so are the chemicals that are artificial sugar.
Yeah. No,
so
you're right.
Why are we not focusing on all soda?
And certainly we're seeing that in some cases people are and you know I've been looking and following a lot and being involved with the sugary drinks tax campaigns, and certain that have had these tax campaigns have included diet sodas. Philadelphia, for instance, is one of seven municipalities with a sugary drinks tax, and it includes diet drinks.
Oh, it does.
And Cook County, which is home to Chicago, passed a sugary drinks tax that also included diet soda, but unfortunately the industry went hard after the commissioners there that had passed that tax, and they recently repealed it. So all the taxes are all structured slightly differently in each municipality that has explored these taxes to date, which is, like I said, seven in the United States and many more globally. And I think we will see going forward an interest in including diet sodas in some of these tax structures going forward. But, you know, what I've found from the folks that I work with on this issue in the public health community is there's a real caution in the public health community to ensure that public policies are based in robust, peer-reviewed literature. And I think we're just still at the beginning of what I think, although I need to preface this all by saying I myself am not, you know, an epidemiologist. But I think we are going to see over the course of the next couple of years more and more literature in the peer-reviewed journals that are going to be connecting the dots between diet soda and other health impacts. And so I think that will change the public health community's approach to some of these taxes. But, you know, I appreciate they're very, you know, they know that these taxes have to be absolutely Teflon against industry attack. And so they've been grounding them in, you know, where the most robust literature is. And that is certainly in the irrefutable impact that consuming liquid sugar has on our bodies. And so I appreciate their caution, but I also am eager to see more, you know, more of the science come out around the impacts of diet sodas, which we've just begun to see. And I think we will see a lot more of. And I certainly agree with you around the really damaging health impacts sodas as well.
Yeah, because the sad thing is so many people that are buying soda buy it because it's a cheap drink, and the soda tax, I just feel like, then pushes them to drink the diet soda instead, you know, and they're using their SNAP dollars for that, and, you know, it's just, as you know, it's just not a good alternative.
Well, one of the things we're seeing in the communities that have organized to pass these taxes is an incredible increase in consumer awareness and education about soda in general. Mm-hmm. And so while not most of the taxes have not included diet sodas, a lot of the messaging, communication, the popular education has been about the benefits of drinking water and has been about the impacts of sugary drinks, including diet sodas. And so I think that you are seeing a raising of awareness, even in communities where those sodas aren't being taxed. And also what you're seeing is a big emphasis in the communities that have passed the tax about, you know, how do you really create a culture of water drinking, and, you know, how do you get, you know, really get people access to clean drinkable water. In Boulder, Colorado, that passed the tax, one of the first initiatives that they've embarked on with the revenue from the tax, which is so far $1.5 million, probably it's going to be more than that going forward, but $1.5 million a year. They assessed their lowest income community members and the needs that they had, and they found that many of their most low income community members in Boulder live in mobile home parks that have no tap water, that have no drinkable water. And so one of the first things they did was invest in water stations in the mobile home parks to get people access to fresh water. So again, you know, I think when you bring these tax campaigns into a community, you both raise awareness about the impacts of sugar drinks, but you also raise revenue to really promote water, access to water, and promote campaigns for clean drinking water. And I think that's what people really need to be able to get themselves off of all of these sugary drinks.
Yeah, that's great. Anna, we're going to need to take a couple-minute break, and when we come back, I want to talk about how our food system contributes to climate change. I know you've been talking about that a lot, and I think really, you know, people need to hear that more. So everyone, don't go anywhere. I'm talking with Anna Lapay from the Small Planet Institute and Real Food Media, and you're listening to Bhavani at IE Green. We'll be right back.
You're listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and I'm talking with Anna Lappe from the Small Planet Institute and Real Food Media. And we were just getting ready to talk about how our food industry and agricultural food system that we know, how it contributes to climate change. So, Anna, how are you?
Good.
Good. So, can you give us, you know, a little bit of background on how our current food system is contributing to climate change, and there's also some really exciting ways that that we know agriculture or small farm agriculture can actually help mitigate some of the problems. So can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Sure. So, you know, big picture, what's really important to understand is that, of course, I think more and more we see just how much farmers and our food system is so vulnerable to the impacts of climate change. You can look at the 13,000 farmers who were effectively destroyed by the hurricane in Puerto Rico, which is one of the most recent terrible examples. But I think it's really important for us to stress that the food industry and global agricultural production is a key culprit in the crisis as well. And so if we're talking about how do we address the crisis, how do we reduce greenhouse gas emissions, food has to be part of that conversation. And then the final key message I really want people to understand is that when you invest in the kind of agriculture that is better for the environment, that reduces on-farm energy use and reduces greenhouse gas emissions, you're talking about a kind of farming, organic agriculture or agroecology. It's a kind of farming that builds up healthy soils and really creates farms that are more resilient in the face of droughts or in the face of flooding. And there's a lot of research already that shows just how resilient farms can be who adopt these sustainable practices. Big picture, if you want to know just how big of an impact the food system has globally, emissions associated with our food, so that's everything from production on the land to deforestation related to expansion of commodity production to synthetic fertilizer, both its production and use, all of that, animal production, all of that combined, you're talking about one-third of all greenhouse gas emissions can be traced back to our food sector. So it's a really big player.
Wow.
And, yeah. And so, and I guess my other, you know, main point is that in talking about food and climate, that's where I actually feel like a lot of hope lies, in that when you look at what are some of the most immediate steps we could take to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, it's in food. You know, what are some of the most, you know, the steps we could take to have the biggest bang for our buck in terms of halting the escalation of greenhouse gas emissions, it's in the food sector.
And is that a statistic, one-third of greenhouse gas emissions, is that just in the United States or is that globally?
No, I'm sorry. Yeah, no, I said global greenhouse gas emissions, or at least I hope I did, because that's a global figure. And when you look at the percentage in the United States, it's a much smaller slice of our overall global impact and emissions that are produced inside the United States. And that's because we are such a big energy producer. We have so much transport in this country. But the figure one-third is a global figure. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that it is agricultural expansion and agricultural land use that has been such a big driver of deforestation, which we know is associated, you know, a big factor in climate change. But I would also stress that it's a little bit hard to slice and dice what emissions are, what we might call, you know, United States-based or quote-unquote our emissions, because, of course, we are importing a lot of food. And, of course, our companies that are housed here in the United States are, of course, involved with global commodity productions of, you know, palm oil or corn or soy or beef in other countries. So it's not quite so easy to say, you know, those are somebody else's emissions, you know, over the outside of our borders.
Right.
You know, I think clearly a global issue.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a global issue that we need to, you know, take on. And our U.S.-based food companies are, you know, a key driver of the crisis.
Uh-huh. Now, if you were to encourage individuals to make one or two changes in their daily lives that would impact the food system and our environment, what would they be?
Well, it's a great question. I would say there's like the easy thing, and then there's the bigger picture, harder thing. And the easy thing is, of course, that there are ways you can align your food choices with food that's going to have less of an impact on the environment and less of the impact on climate. And many of these things might be choices your listeners are already making if they're listening to your show. These are choices like looking for organic certified food. Organic certified production is much lower greenhouse gas emissions and on-farm use. It also means if you eat meat and dairy, to eat less meat and dairy, and to be sure you're choosing meat and dairy that's been either if it's beef, grass-fed, 100% grass-fed, or if it's dairy, organic, certified. Again, those production models have less of an environmental impact. But the second, more kind of bigger picture, trickier thing, but I think something we all can and should do as well, is to realize that, you know, to really make a change with a crisis as big as climate change, it's going to mean more than just shopping differently. It's really going to mean thinking about our role in, you know, in the universe differently. It's going to be really thinking about what you can do in your community to make sure you're electing leaders who represent your voice, making sure your leaders understand these connections between food and climate change, making sure you have leaders that do things like pass the good food purchasing program because they understand that, yes, it's a health and wellness program, but it's also going to help the climate and the environment. So I think it's definitely this moment in time calls us to do a lot with our lives, and it means stepping up in a much bigger way maybe than we ever have before to be advocates for the kind of food system that we need.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is, and I know it's also so overwhelming. I mean, you know, I am active, and I am overwhelmed by mm-hmm. all the calls for,
right.
you know, marches and donations and showing up and, you know, and then you have your regular life that you have to take care of, just, you know, family and
right.
kids and everything. It's really, you know, so many people are really struggling, I think, with depression
sure.
over all
no.
of this.
Oh yeah, for sure. And I've certainly experienced some of the most difficult times in my life over the past couple months with just how, as you said, how overwhelming it is. But I think when I can come to remembering that, of course, we are all only one person, and there is no way any one of us is going to be able to take it all on, and it doesn't help you, your family, or, you know, your community if you try to do too much and you do get overwhelmed. And so it's really figuring out what can you do, and maybe it's, you know, if you're already, you know, working two jobs and have three kids and are totally overwhelmed, it isn't much more than just being a little bit more conscious about what you're putting on your plate for right now.
Right.
And then when you have the opportunity, when you're, you know, we all are voting, when you have the opportunity to really do, you know, to do your homework to understand who best represents your values. So I think it's important for us not to get overwhelmed, but for us to see, are there places where maybe we can stretch a bit more than we ever have before? And again, it doesn't help anybody for all of us to get completely overwhelmed and burned out. But I do think that it does feel energizing when you stretch yourself and you try to take risks and to try to be more bold than you've been before, and to realize, you know, this is our one shot at you know, one shot at it. And so,
right.
But yes, I definitely am not prescribing overwhelmed. That's not helpful.
Right. Well, you know, I actually spoke with someone recently who said, you know, I said, how do you manage to not get depressed over all of this? And they said, you know, when they have found that those that just read the paper and stay trying to just take it all in on their own have a much more difficult time with feeling
yeah.
overwhelmed and getting depressed. But if you're actually mm-hmm. out there working with other people in community trying to make a difference, you get energized by that, and it gives you hope because you see
mm-hmm.
others are doing things, and you're not just mm-hmm. sitting by waiting for it to get better, but you're actually working towards it. And, you know, I think that really does help.
Oh, absolutely. And I feel like that's like the secret of activism for people who aren't advocates or haven't had that experience before who don't know. You know, it's fun and it's a great way to meet people, and it does energize you. And, you know, I think that it is, it makes you, again, it makes you feel like you're doing something and can sort of get you out of yourself in a way that's really helpful.
Before you came on, when I was just perusing through your websites, I came upon a book club that you have that I thought was just a really great idea. Can you tell us about that? Because I have to tell you, then when I went back to try to find it, I couldn't find it. So
yes, well, we are getting a new website by the end of the year. So when you go to Real Food Media in the next couple months, hopefully everything will be really easy to find. But the easiest way to find our book club is just to go to Apple Podcasts and subscribe. It's called Real Food Reads, and it's a monthly podcast, and we focus on some of the best and most interesting books on food, and it's an interview I host monthly with the author of a book a month. And we also encourage listeners to join a book club, a Real Food Reads book club, or start one of their own. So if you go to realfoodmedia.org, you can find information about the book club there. And it's been really fun. It's been a fun way for me to really stay in touch with, you know, people who I think are writing some of the most important books right now on these topics. And it's been a blast. So you can listen to those podcasts anytime. You can go back into our archives. Hopefully the conversations that I have with the authors are interesting and informative enough that if you don't have time to read the book, this is sort of your Cliff's Notes version of the book. And if you have ideas for books that we should be covering, you can write to us at Real Food Media as well and let us know.
Great, because I love that idea. I do think book clubs are just such a wonderful way to, you know, delve into a book and a topic and, you know, and just not, again, be in your bubble. You know, I just think more and more of us really, you know, this day and age, you really have to create community because it's not just always there and, you know, and so easy to find. You have to really put yourself in places with people that you want to be connecting on and connecting with and do it. And so the book club is just a wonderful way to do it. So thanks for adding that to your list of things that you're doing. I also wanted to ask you any suggestions on how people can get involved in fighting the big corporations like Monsanto. I mean, when you read about the manipulations of the scientific facts, you know, kind of like the tobacco companies did, and their cozy relations with the EPA, and then, of course, we now have Scott Pruitt, who's running the EPA, who's, like, ridiculous. What are we supposed to do? Any suggestions?
Well, you mentioned Monsanto by name. I mean, I think being educated about the issues is one important thing we can do, and perhaps the most important book on this topic is a new book that just came out that we have a podcast about at Real Food Reads called Whitewash, and it's by a veteran journalist named Carrie Gillum about glyphosate, which is the weed killer that is in a formulation Monsanto product that's the most widely used weed killer in the country called Roundup. There's genetically engineered seeds that are called Roundup Ready that can be sprayed with this weed killer, and they survive, and all the anything living around them dies. So this glyphosate, this weed killer, has been presented by Monsanto for decades as benign, harmless. And this new book exposes how much evidence there is about the real harm that glyphosate can cause to public health, and about the ties between Monsanto and the regulators. And so, you know, one thing I think we can all do is to get educated. And in the case of Monsanto, I think this book is a really important piece of that education.
Yeah, I think one of the biggest problems also is that we rely on industry scientific research as the research. I mean, I was shocked when I found that the Environmental Protection Agency doesn't do their own research on testing these products, that they trust the corporations producing them. And corporations producing them, if they come up with negative information from one of their research projects, they don't have to publicize that one. They can just hide that one, as we've seen. It's probably in that book. And just, you know, go with ones that paint the picture of it being harmless and benign. So, you know, and yet with this administration, we're certainly not going to, didn't find money with the Obama administration. We're certainly not going to find money now with this one to do any of our own testing. So I think we're just kind of stuck in that reality, right?
Yeah, and I think you're right. I mean, I think most people don't realize that. Most people assume that we have regulations based in the neutral evidence when, as you said, you know, most of the regulations are based on testing that's been commissioned by the companies themselves. So highly suspect. So, you know, I think that, you know, how do we get around that? Well, in an administration like the one we have today, where regulators are even more inclusion with industry, it's really tough. But I think one thing that advocates are looking at is, you know, what are some things that we can win at the state levels? Are there state, you know, state policies we can pass? Are there municipal policies that we can pass? Things like buffer zones between agricultural toxic pesticide spraying and schools or nursery schools. Are there policies that can help do some of that protective work that don't require the EPA fundamentally changing the way it's been doing business for so long?
Between farms, between an organic mm-hmm. farmer and an industrial farmer, you know, exactly. We need buffer zones.
And so I do think that there's progress being made at the state and the local level, and that's where I think we can start having some real progress made and really start having some precedent set for policies that, you know, can sort of be tested at that state level that might make their way to a federal policy in a more people-friendly administration.
Right. Wow. Very informative. Anna, you're doing just such great work, and we're just about out of time. Before we end, can you share with everybody your website one more time, or your websites, so that people can go where they need to go to find all this wonderful information?
Great. Well, again, thank you so much for having me on. Always fun. And people can go to realfoodmedia.org to link to all this various things that I discussed today. And then you can also see the organization that I co-founded with my mother can be found at smallplanet.org. But you can find our work in both those places. And we always welcome hearing from folks about what they want to see us do and how they're using our resources and getting connected.
Thank you. Thanks so much for the work that you're doing. It's awesome, and I look forward to you coming into New York anytime soon. Any events?
Not anytime soon. I was just there, actually. I heard you announcing the Mark Bittman speaker series, which if anybody can make their way up there, I highly recommend it. And I spoke at his class earlier in October, and it was a really great experience. But not in the near future, but I do make it back a couple times a year.
Okay, well, next time I hope I see you. Everyone out there, thank you so much for joining us. You've been listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and I've been talking with Anna Lappe from Real Food Media. See you all again next week. Bye for now.